I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. In A Thousand Dreams, a new book, there's a photograph from September 1901 of crowds assembling around Hastings and Canby awaiting, amongst others, the Duke and Duchess of Cornwall. This week, we're expecting in Canada the Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall. They'll be at SFU on Saturday on West Hastings, but I doubt Charles and Camilla will venture eastward into the heart of Vancouver's downtown east side. Neil Boyd joins me now, the noted Simon Fraser University criminologist, is the co-author of a fascinating new book that's part history, part analysis, and part prescription of Vancouver's downtown east side. The beginning of the book is an astonishingly good history of the country's poorest neighborhood, one that's home to many Vancouverites at risk due to addiction and homelessness. It's also instructive to other urban centers in North America. The authors call for the decriminalization of prostitution and drugs, the continuing of InSight, the safe injection site, more social housing, and the transfer of addiction services to the health ministry. The book is called A Thousand Dreams, Vancouver's Downtown East Side and the Fight for Its Future. It's published by Greystone and co-authored by Neil Boyd, Senator and former Mayor Larry Campbell, and the Vancouver Sun's Laurie Culbert. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Neil Boyd. Good morning, Professor Boyd.
Good morning.
So the history at the beginning of the book, as I said, is just tremendous. I guess I always assumed that the name Downtown Eastside was that throughout its history. It was known as Skid Row, I guess, but you write in the book that it was Bruce Erickson who coined that term, I guess?
Yeah, he famous statement, we call it the Downtown Eastside. And it was another of those voices standing up for what we argue is a very resilient community. People who live there are committed to the neighborhood and who have offered a different point of view from the more traditional portrait that you often see in the media.
The subtitle of your book is The Fight for Its Future. Who or what is the opposition to that?
Well, that's a good question. Some of the problems, I suppose the major problem is really one of how, in many respects, the area has kind of fallen apart over the last 15 years or been under siege for a number of different reasons. One has to do with the failure to build supportive housing in 1993. The Liberal government of Jean Chrétien got out of the business of building supportive housing, and the provincial government followed suit to Gordon Campbell in 2000. The Campbell government has since reversed itself and has become very active in building social housing, but at the federal level, nothing's happened. So we've got a real dramatic drop in supportive housing, deinstitutionalization, people who have mental health and often addiction issues being released from various institutions, and they end up on the downtown east side because that's an area that they find comfortable, and they self-medicate and they get into lots of different difficulties. So you've got lack of support housing, deinstitutionalization, and then the emergence of crack cocaine, which was a much more destructive drug than heroin was. And those three features have combined to make something of a perfect storm, to put the community under a considerable amount of stress and difficulty. You still have a lot of people who are fighting to provide for that community, Rain City, the Portland Hotel Society. There are many people who are committed to trying to serve the community down there. You've got this other stress of gentrification, or what some people refer to as gentrification, which is try to create more of a mixed community. So on the one hand, you want to not have a community that's entirely non-market, entirely supportive government-built housing. You want to have a mixed community. On the other hand, you worry that if you bring in too much market housing, or you bring it in a manner that isn't careful, you could have a displacement of the people who are currently living in that community or who are part of that neighborhood.
And I guess that's Woodward's, right?
I think Woodward's is a good concept, and I think, you know, it's got social housing, it's got market housing, and it's got university involvement, and I think those are all good things for the neighborhood. The more subtle test over time will be whether the people who live down there, you know, just end up not feeling comfortable with some of the changes and get pushed out in less direct ways. On the other hand, there are those who argue that, you know, we have many people in the downtown east side who came with their difficulties from other communities, from other parts of the Lower Mainland, British Columbia, and indeed the entire country. And there are nation states around the world, Switzerland comes to mind, where the goal has been that local communities take responsibilities for their problem and they don't just dump them into one central area. And some of the people we talked to felt that, you know, the downtown east side, you don't want it to be a dumping ground for people from outside with problems. On the other hand, you know, you can see from being involved with some of the people there and just studying the history that this is a community that does care about people who we might describe as wounded, who are compromised in various ways, and the people who live down there provide and support. And so you don't want to attack that resiliency. You don't want to attack in any way the fact that the people down there, many of them are have difficulties and are compromised, and there is support for people. You don't want to just push them off where they don't get support. On the other hand, you don't want to create a community that is just thought of by everywhere else in the country and everywhere else in the province as a place where you send your problems.
Now, you mentioned that
it's a funny tension.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that in the last 15 years it's gotten worse. Is this the worst that it's ever been throughout its history?
Oh, I think so. I mean, we've got more homeless people on the street. We've got more visible difficulties with drug addiction and mental illness. And we've got crack cocaine, which has to be, alcohol is still the number one drug problem down there. There's no doubt about that. And if you look at what people die from there or anywhere else in our country, it's still alcohol and tobacco. But certainly crack cocaine, of all the illegal drugs, has to be the most destructive. And, when you add that to alcohol and tobacco, it's a pretty nasty mix.
Now, your co-author, Senator Campbell, now the former mayor, he seemed to have a grasp on the area and devoted much of his time as mayor to the area. Looking back, did he have much of an impact?
Oh, I think he did. I mean, you know, I think that you think of the supervised injection site. That was something that he spoke up for. To look at how, I mean, it's Larry had a lot to do with the changes. We ultimately, I think, would trace it back to Philip Owen. He was an unlikely standard, torchbearer for change, coming from the MPA, beginning to see drug addiction as a health issue. Larry Campbell had begun to see the same thing as a police officer, as a coroner, and then as mayor. I think it started with Philip Owen, and I suppose it's the whole movement starts in international context, but in Vancouver, Philip Owen was crucially important, and Larry carried on that work as mayor, and of course it reflected what he'd seen as coroner, all of these overdose deaths, people dying with needles in their arms, and 300 heroin overdose deaths in a year, going back to the 1990s.
Now, so it's been some time since Larry Campbell's been mayor. Has it gotten worse since then?
No, I don't. I mean, I think not really. I think that if anything, it's been kind of static. But the problems to make things better, the problems that have to be overcome have to do with building of supportive housing. And we're seeing some progress there. Rich Coleman, as the responsible minister in BC, has done a lot in terms of buying up the hotels, taking them out of the hands of drug dealers, and turning them back into the hands of nonprofits. Those are positive things. We need to do more of that. The federal government is the government that's really dragging its heels. It is not coming to the table. It is not providing social housing at the level that's needed, and they need to be part of the equation. I think that there's no doubt that the city and the province are committed to some of the changes that we need to see there, but it's the resources are what we need, and the resources are really held by the federal government.
What's the future of Insight?
Well, the future of Insight, I suppose you could say, is in the courts at the moment, but I think Insight will remain open. I think it's every once in a while people want to get upset about it because they say it doesn't reduce crime or it doesn't do X, Y, or Z. Well, Insight exists as a public health service for people who use injectable drugs, and it's designed to prevent HIV infection, prevent overdose death, and provide referrals, diagnostics, etc. So it's a health service. It's a health initiative. It's no accident it comes from Vancouver Coastal Health, and I am quite confident that it will remain open, independent ultimately of what the courts decide. I think that there will be compromises that will result in Insight continuing. I would add at the same time that I do see the Harper Conservatives as a threat to Enlightened policy with respect to Insight.
It has had an impact, though.
I don't think there's much doubt that it's had an impact in terms of study we did, myself and Martin Andreessen, one of my colleagues, back in 2008 for Health Canada. One of the things we found was that both HIV infection and overdose deaths were being prevented at a cost that ultimately resulted in savings to the healthcare system. When you look at the cost of running Insight vis-a-vis the in relation to the costs of overdose death and the cost of HIV infection, and we had all kinds of data regarding diagnostics, regarding referral that we did look at. So I expect that it returns much more in the way of benefits to its cost ratio than we anticipated or than we were able to evaluate.
You recommend in the book that the transfer of addiction services should be made to the health ministry. What would that achieve?
Well, I mean, in many ways, I suppose it's symbolic, but,
I'm wondering, how is it done now? Like, how are the services there? Where are they coming from?
Well, it's more silo that we're getting at there than anything else. It's just you need to have a kind of a coordination around provision of health services, and we've got a patchwork quilt. Some of it's justice, some of it's health, some of it's Solicitor General, and the point needs to be made that it is fundamentally a health issue.
You also call for the decriminalization of prostitution and drugs. There's a lot of opposition to that, as you're probably well aware. What do you think that would achieve?
Well, when we say decriminalization of drugs, I think I would prefer to say that we favor a public health approach to drugs, and it depends on the drug. Each drug's a little different. We have very different policies, for example, with tobacco and alcohol. You know, you can drink alcohol on a plane, you can't smoke tobacco. We all understand the logic behind that. When you get to cannabis, it's obviously not of the same order of magnitude in terms of concern as is crack or heroin or any injectable drug. So we certainly favor decriminalization of cannabis. Not that that's going to have a huge impact on the downtown east side, but what we do favor is the possibility of expanding the NAOMI program, so heroin prescription, and at least looking at how we can better handle crack. We don't think it's a good idea to criminalize people who are using crack. On the other hand, we're not prepared to advocate sale of crack in drugstores or anything of that kind. And it's just that what we're arguing for is understanding that these are public health problems, and we don't want to see widespread distribution of crack cocaine. But it may be that for some people, some kind of stimulant maintenance program might work. I haven't seen a lot of encouraging evidence to date about that. I have seen a lot more encouraging evidence about heroin replacement programs, that is, heroin maintenance programs in contrast to any kind of stimulant maintenance program. So it's complicated. It varies from one drug to the next. With prostitution, it's not all that complicated. I mean, we have massage parlors, escort agencies that basically run without much legal interference, and where the women don't seem to get aren't nearly as likely to be harmed as are street prostitutes. So we need to do something to protect street prostitutes, and it's clear now that criminalizing either their customers or themselves it increases the danger, the risk that they face. And although some would say, "Oh well, just criminalize the men, don't criminalize the women," the problem with that is it just drives the whole process further underground and makes their lives even more dangerous. I mean, that was how the Picton farm worked. It's in the shadows, in the underground. What we're saying is, no, don't use criminal law against this. It's not a matter of encouraging prostitution. It makes good social policy sense to discourage it, but don't use the criminal law as a way of dealing with this issue.
Now, the Olympics have obviously had an impact on the area. Do you see that there are, because of the Olympics, that there are people there who have been displaced out of housing, social housing, hotels and the sort?
Well, you know, I think that it was pretty compelling with Expo 86, but that was 5 months. We don't make the argument in the book that the Olympics have had a major impact on the downtown east side. You do see hints or suggestions that the Olympics might have an impact when you see the possibility of forcing people into shelters and so on, and legitimate questions are raised about whether that's related to the Olympics, because the timing seems somewhat suspicious, I suppose. But while we do make the point that Expo had an impact on the downtown east side in terms of displacing people, the Olympics is 2 weeks, and the displacement that I see to date seems to be more around relatively wealthy people renting out their homes, condominiums and townhomes for 2 weeks for rather exorbitant rates.
Now, what does the downtown east side experience here in Vancouver speak universally to other urban centers on the continent that they could learn from? What's instructive, do you think?
Well, I think that the homelessness issues are really critical. And I don't think that we are going to see, particularly in Canada, great differences around that issue as we go from city to city, because it's, although it's most pronounced in our more major cities, and it's particularly pronounced in the downtown east side, but what we can see is that the failure to build supportive housing and deinstitutionalization have led to a greater number of people on the street, and these people are on the street with both mental health and substance abuse difficulties, a dual diagnosis in many cases. And we can learn from the book something about how that problem was created and what we need to do to improve the situation. I'm certainly old enough to have grown up in an era when homelessness was virtually non-existent in all major Canadian cities, and it's very prevalent now. And we collectively have created this problem, and we collectively have to resolve it if we have compassion for people who are less fortunate than ourselves.
In your work as a criminologist, do you see a need for? I don't know if a need for is, I've phrased that incorrectly, but that there should be an area like the downtown east side that, because when we think of addiction and the sort, the desire has always been to get addicts out of that cycle, to help them. I'm thinking that the downtown east side probably creates and probably promotes sort of these problems and issues. Do you think that there should be a downtown east side?
Well, I wouldn't agree that the downtown east side promotes these problems. I think the downtown east side
it gives us an area where this is not, I wouldn't say encouraged, but where this is allowed to flourish, perhaps.
Yeah, but I think the way I understand that is that if you are somebody who has, for example, been released from an institution and you don't have any resources and you have some pretty significant mental health issues, where are you going to feel welcome? Where are you going to feel comfortable? Well, the downtown east side is an area that you can drift into. You self-medicate. There's a great degree of tolerance in that area for unusual behavior. And so one understands how this problem accelerates over time when we let it happen, when we didn't build supportive communities in response to deinstitutionalization. Is it something that we should just, promote in the sense that we should encourage more people to come down to the downtown east side and particularly more people with difficulties? No, I don't think so at all. I think, the better model is one of people, irrespective of the difficulties that they have, substance abuse, mental illness, growing up in communities of support and living lifelong in in communities of support where they know their neighbors, where they feel part of that community. The downtown east side does provide that community for people, and many of the people who live and work there are really providing a marvelous service. I have just done such good work. I think of people like Ann Livingston and Mark Townsend and Liz, and there's so many people, Bud Osborne, people who have made such significant contributions to supporting people that I wouldn't want to say that, oh, well, the answer is to, you know, throw a small device down there that would just disintegrate the place. I think it's a lot more complicated.
How did the three of you get together to write this book?
Well, it's an interesting question. Larry and I sat together at the GVRD. I was the representative from Bowen Island. I served on the Bowen Island Council and was the GVRD rep for 3 years. And we during the meetings, we talked a lot, and we knew each other prior to that experience. We'd be involved with some of the drug issues, and he as coroner, myself as an academic. And at the end of the 3 years, I suggested that we should write a book. And he laughed about the idea initially, but ultimately, he sent me a Christmas card saying, yeah, let's write that book. So we started it, and didn't really get too far. After about a year, the publishers called us in and said, how about a more focused book than a book on drugs and drug policy? How about a book about the downtown east side? And how about you get somebody, you're both very busy, you get somebody who would really take on a lot of the writing and interviewing responsibility. The suggestion that we had, Lori Colbert, was somebody that they went to. She agreed, and she did a marvelous job. Lori deserves an enormous amount of credit. Is really the lead author in this book, and is responsible, more responsible than both of us for the product that we have.
It's a great book. Congratulations to all of you, Professor Boyd, and continued good luck with the book.
Thank you.
The book is called 1,000 Dreams, Vancouver's Downtown East Side and the Fight for Its Future. Neil Boyd, one of its authors, on the line. It's co-written with Larry Campbell and Lori Colbert. It's published by Greystone in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.